When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On the show today, Jason Cowley, the journalist and author, discusses his new book about England and the English, Who Are We Now? Jason Cowley is editor of British political weekly, The New Statesman. He's also an author whose books include the psychological drama Unknown Pleasures and The Last Game, Love, Death and Football, a non-fiction work tracing the evolution of the beautiful game. His latest book is Who Are We Now? Stories of Modern England, a timely reflection on the identity of his home nation. The book follows both individual stories of everyday life and the broad arc of national politics over the past 25 years. Our host today is Kavita Puri, the journalist, broadcaster and author. Her book and accompanying radio series, Partition Voices, explores issues of identity within British Asian communities and the influence of colonial history too. Here's Kavita with more.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, Jason.
Very good to be here, Kavita. Thank you.
Your book takes a deep look at England from the Blair years to now, from identity, culture and the threads that hold us together. And in that time, we went from cool Britannia and hailing multiculturalism to the division of Brexit. And then we saw solidarity during the pandemic, which is where you begin your book. Why did you look at England and English identity as opposed to Britain?
That's the key question, I think. Well, I was born and I've always lived in England. And even from a young age, I was aware of the complexities of living in a multinational state. And I've always had a sense that somewhere England, which is obviously the dominant country in the United Kingdom, I think 84% of the population of the UK lives in England. And the UK has been called by some a mini English empire, perhaps. But I was always aware of that complexity of living in the dominant country in the multinational state. But at the same time, being aware that somehow England and Englishness had been lost within Britishness and Britain. And I think in recent years, as the British state has fragmented and British identity has become more contested, not least because of the rise of Scottish nationalism, I think it's forced upon the English a reconsideration of who they are and what England is. Because if we had an existential referendum in 2014, a Scottish independence referendum, which had that been won by the independent side, would have led to the breakup of the British state. And there was some complacency in England about that, an assumption that that wouldn't happen. Well, it nearly happened. And it didn't. It certainly didn't put the matter to bed. In many ways, it fired the ambitions of the Scottish nationalists. So I was very aware that what happens if Britain breaks out? Where does that leave England and the English, who have been encouraged for so long to think of themselves as British? So that was really the beginning of my reflections, plus the polarisation and the division that followed the Brexit referendum in 2016.
Well, you argue that Blair had a vision of liberal modern Britishness. He was a progressive. In 1995, he talked of being a young country in outlook. He was a Europhile, pitting his vision against a conservative, traditional Englishness. Do you think you can trace the roots of that later division and polarisation in that vision?
I think those early Blair years were very interesting when you look back. Tony Blair was a particular kind of progressive politician, really, very unusual for such a figure to have emerged inside the Labour Party and ultimately to become Prime Minister. But you're right, in 1995, 2 years before he won the first New Labour landslide election in 97, he gave a speech in which he did say, I want this to be a young country. We will be a young country. What he was speaking about was Britain, I think, not England. But he was aware of the weight of the past empire, colonialism, and he wanted somehow to be free from it. And he wanted to kind of reinvent the country as dynamic, open, liberal, progressive. He wanted the country to be right at the center of the European debate, not at the fringes of it. And he wanted to kind of remake the country. And that coincided, as you said at the beginning, with that whole cult of Cor Britannia that we lived through in the mid to late 90s. And that was the Blairite vision. And he wanted to kind of harness the forces of what he called the new globalization, the new market-driven globalization that was kind of transforming the world as Blair saw it in exciting ways and dynamic ways. And he wanted to be part of that. And he wanted to escape from the past. He didn't like the associations that Labour had with the past. He wasn't a socialist. He was a different kind of Labour politician, actually closer in many ways to the Clinton Democrats than to those who had come before him in the Labour Party. And of course, Blair was a brilliant communicator. And one thing he understood is that very successful politicians tell stories. They tell stories about the country that they aspire to lead, and they tell stories about the future, in other words, the direction of travel. And he wanted to tell a particular story about a country that in many ways was a construct of his imagination. It didn't really exist. But for a period, I think a lot of people believed that it did.
You talk about him wanting to escape the past, but did that mean embracing Britishness at the expense of Englishness?
Yes, he had a particular vision of Britishness. He also thought he could solve the sort of the existential crisis of British identity and the complexities of the multinational state about which I spoke at the beginning. In other words, he thought if he introduced his devolution reforms, introduced the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly, the Good Friday Agreement, obviously brought peace to the island of Ireland, he thought that would solve many of the tensions inside these islands. One of his key lieutenants at that time, a guy called George Robertson, who later became head of NATO, he said that devolution would end, in effect, the movement for Scottish independence. It would kill it stone dead. I mean, he couldn't have been more wrong, of course, but that's what they believed. But while they were talking about Scotland and Wales and peace in Ireland, they ignored England and they ignored what was happening, not in London or Manchester or the big dynamic multicultural cities, but what was happening out in the shires and in neglected new towns, the coastal regions, the provincial towns. Something was stirring that Blair ignored. He didn't really want that to be part of the Britain that he was creating. And what was stirring, I think, was what I call in the book an inchoate English revolt.
Well, I think you chart that very well. And what I like about the book is it's very much about respect and dignity, but it's also about disrespect that people felt that they had been shown by those in power, and as well as this kind of sense of powerlessness. And you very much anchor your book in the stories of individuals, and you travel across England far beyond the Westminster bubble. But it's also a really personal story for you, and you include your aunt Connie. Why did you begin your journey in Harlow, Essex, with Connie and the closing of her surgery?
Yes, the book is not a work of polemic or political analysis. It's a book of stories. And I wanted to explore what I call the social atmosphere of the country. It's a phrase George Orwell used. And I thought the best way of exploring the social atmosphere and how we've changed over the last 25 years was to tell stories. And one of the themes of the book, it's about crossing of borders. It's about journeys. It's about people who are coming into the country, people who are leaving the country. I write about the young Bethnal Green girls, for example, who go to Islamic State. They leave their homes and go to Syria. It's about migrants coming in, people who want to leave. But it's also about journeys within the country and crossing borders inside England itself. And I make a return journey. One of the journeys I make is to go back to my hometown, which was Harlow, Essex, where I was born and grew up. It was one of the new towns created after the Second World War by the Clement Attlee Labour government, an attempt to create housing and a decent environment for working class people, many of them living in the bomb districts of East London and northeast London. And after the war, there was a great need for housing and to resettle people. and a series of new towns were created around London. One of them was Harlow, which was an old settlement. It's mentioned in the Domesday Book. It was a network of villages, and they built the town around the villages. In effect, they kind of didn't erase them. They sort of subsumed them into this huge, what became a huge new town. And it was a utopian project. Clement Attlee spoke about creating the New Jerusalem, and it was a social democratic project, and it was about trying to sort of bring dignity to ordinary people's lives. And my parents, they were married in the 1950s, they moved out to the town from the East End of London, and my mother's oldest sister had made a journey before them. She was called Connie, and she settled in a part of the town called Potterstreet, which was one of the old villages, but had grown alongside the new town. And actually, I was born in Potterstreet, in a little flat above a bakery, in a place called Prentice Place. And directly opposite where we lived was the doctor's surgery, Osler House. And I can see it now as I looked out of the window of our flat, directly at the doctor's surgery, which opened in 1955. Now, fast forward to 2018, and my aunt is now 90, and she received a letter saying that the doctor's surgery would close. There was no explanation. There was no consultation. It was a fait accompli. The local MP, a Conservative politician called Robert Halfon, wasn't consulted. The local council wasn't consulted. And she was horrified. And what it would mean that a lady of 90 would have to take four buses, in effect, to reach a doctor's surgery where she would be relocated along with thousands of other patients. So it was a terrible thing to happen, and it deeply saddened and shocked her. And she started a little campaign to try and stop it. There was some interest from the newspapers, from the BBC. And what we discovered was that actually the ultimate owners of the Prentice Place NHS doctor surgery was an American conglomerate. And they'd taken the decision to close it because it was so-called not cost-effective. And my aunt told me that she was heartbroken by the decision. And it also really, I begin the book with her story, not only because briefly it gathered national attention, but because it told us something bigger, I think, about the social atmosphere of the country, you know, what was going wrong, what had gone wrong in Harlow, and why Harlow was a kind of microcosm of other things that had gone wrong elsewhere in the country, which I think was reflected in the 2016 vote for Brexit and that resonant slogan, take back control. Because what the people of Potterstreet had lost, I think, was a sense of control over their lives. They were dispossessed, but they also, I think, they felt deeply humiliated that such a decision could be taken without even any form of consultation. And I thought that told us something important about how the country had changed and how the country was changing. So it's not only is it a poignant story, I think, it's a story with political resonance. So I begin by telling that story.
It is a very poignant story, and it really profoundly leads to this sense of dispossession. I want to look at dispossession and try and locate where that may have begun. Was it the 2008 crash, do you think, which led to the decade of austerity, which led to kind of huge cuts in public spending?
I think it possibly preceded the financial crisis, but the financial crisis was such a huge event. And the consequences were what became the Great Recession, and then a period of prolonged austerity as the coalition government, Conservative-led coalition government, attempted to kind of reduce the budget deficit as they saw it. And do you remember the rhetoric at that time was we were all in it together? And I don't think we were, because certain communities were adversely affected by austerity. And already there had been a kind of decay of the public realm. Already the public spaces in which we work and live and gather and commune had become degraded, I think, through neglect and underinvestment. And we saw that very acutely in Harlow, for instance. I mean, the Harlow I remember growing up there as a young boy in the 1970s, with its wonderful public facilities and its parks and play schemes and libraries, and a wonderfully clean and well-resourced town centre compared to what the town became sort of 20, 25 years later, when it was in many ways like a ghost town, particularly the town centre, full of empty and neglected buildings. And we see this repeated across the country, particularly in smaller towns, when you just have to visit the local high street and shop. There are so many sort of semi-derelict shops or charity shops where they're all run once thriving community shops. And I find that profoundly upsetting in so many ways. So that sense of dispossession was exacerbated, I think, by austerity that followed the financial crisis, but it was already there. It's about the kind of society that we want to be and how we value the public spaces in which we gather, I think. I mean, it's that idea of sort of private affluence and public squalor. And that does worry me as someone who believes in the politics of the common good as I do. So, yeah, you're right to zone in on austerity. And the story about my aunt's doctor surgery is certainly a story of the consequences of austerity, I think.
The book is about journeys, and people were making journeys out of Harlow. I mean, you made that journey, and over the years, more of your friends did, and you know, young people were leaving. But the book is also about journeys into the country. And one of the most affecting stories is of Li Hua, who undertakes, I mean, the most perilous journey over a year from China to Britain, only to be met by disaster in Morecambe Bay. We know that Blair embraced open borders and globalization, but you were showing us its very ugly underbelly. Just tell us about Li Hua and why you included that story.
Yeah, this is Li Hua, who some of your listeners may recall was one of the cockle pickers who ended up on Morecambe Bay, picking shellfish, clams from the sands, which were then gathered together, bundled together, and then sold particularly to European markets. And a lot of those workers on the Morecambe Bay sands in the northwest of England were undocumented migrant Chinese labourers, trafficked labourers in effect, who had come into the country illegally. And there was a terrible disaster where they were out one night in February 2004, out very far out on the sands. And it's a treacherous, the sands are treacherous. They have hidden channels and fast-moving tidal waters that suddenly at short notice come surging in. And that happened to them on that occasion, and they were cut off, abandoned, alone out there on the sands, dark during a winter night, pouring with rain, winds ripping across the sands, and more than 20 of the Chinese workers drowned. They died out on those sands. I mean, it was a national scandal and a tragedy. And we were horrified because nobody really knew, so they claimed, that this was happening out there on the sands, and nobody knew who these people were. They were just shadows that were just ignored. And as someone said, they were operating in plain sight because, of course, we saw them, but we chose not to see them. We ignored them. And Li Hua was the sole survivor who was pulled out of the waters that night by a search helicopter. Miraculous that he survived. So all these years later, I tracked him down. I wanted to find out what happened, you know, who he was, how he ended up on the beach, and how he came to be in England. And after he was rescued, there was obviously a police investigation, and the local gang members were arrested and prosecuted, and Li was one of the witnesses giving evidence against them. He had to do so under witness protection for fear for his own safety. So he was given a new identity. So he has that identity today. He has a family and he set up a business. So his story has had a happy ending. But what I wanted to find out was how he ended up on those sands. And what I didn't know, and I don't think anyone knew, was that a journey which should have taken a week. I mean, he paid some money in his village in China, a lot of money, to come to England, where he'd been promised accommodation and a job by the so-called local sort of snakehead gang, as they were called, the snakeheads. But in effect, the journey took about 15 months. He had to go to Beijing and then to Moscow, where he was spent months in a house in Moscow with other Chinese workers. Then he was taken to Ukraine. Then he was taken to Slovakia. Then he was taken to Germany, where a group of them were detained. And then he was in a detention center. And then inexplicably, rather than being returned to China, he was released from a detention center in Germany. And then he went to the Netherlands. And then he went to France. And so it went on. Eventually, he came across the Channel, English Channel, in the back of a lorry with other undocumented migrant workers, all Chinese. Eventually, when the lorry arrived in England, he was immediately arrested, detained again for a couple of days, then released, ended up in Soho in Chinatown, in London, where he was given an address to go to in Liverpool, in the northwest of England. He went to the address in Liverpool. The house was full of ill, thin, emaciated, impoverished Chinese workers. Most of them had come in into the Liverpool docks on a ship, some of them from the north of China, some of them from the south. He was ill, fatigued, but nevertheless, the next day he was sent onto the sands to pick cockles. You know, that was his first day, in effect, working in England, was on Morecambe Bay as a cockle picker. And that was his first day of work, and his first day of work was when the disaster happened. I mean, it is a truly remarkable story. Occasionally during that long journey, he would make phone calls home and his wife would plead for him to return to the farm where he had lived and worked with his father. But because he was in debt to the gangmaster, he'd paid all of this money, he was in effect trapped. So really, it's a story about what I call the dark shadow of globalization. And I'm very interested in people who we see all around us. They're working in nail bars, you know, they're working in restaurant kitchens, they're working as fruit pickers or as cockle pickers. We see them, but we don't really see them. We have no idea how they came to be here, about their inner lives, the suffering that they've endured. And I just wanted to really tell that story from his point of view. So I spoke to him, I interviewed him. We had a very long conversation, and I drew on what he told me to tell the story from his point of view. And I think it's the story in the book that has been particularly well received.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
I mean, it is a very shocking story. And I think what you do very well is, you know, there are all these statistics, but we get behind that statistics and we see this one man's extraordinary journey. And what really struck me was how he said he just wanted honest work. He wanted to come here and pay his taxes. And, you know, it wasn't like that for him. But he also now says he feels a sense of belonging here. But I suppose in the immigration debate, people see him as a threat. And immigration comes up time and again in your book. And you argue that the fear of it was compounded by stagnant wages and spending cuts and weakened public services, as well as you're covering a time when there was expansion of people coming in from Eastern Europe. Do you think that when we're talking about Englishness, there is also this fear of otherness?
There is, Kavita, I think. You know, I welcome immigration. I welcome the multiracial diversity of the country as it is today. And that's one of the themes of the book, how we can create a kind of more cohesive sense of Englishness as well as Britishness. Britishness was always a more welcoming identity, I think, than Englishness. Englishness, for whatever reason, for some, there was always a sense of uncertainty and unease about it, perhaps because of associations with empire and colonialism and even whiteness. Whereas Britishness was very much, or has been, it's non-racial, it's civic, it's inclusive, it's plural. And many of my friends whose parents were born outside the UK have always been very comfortable with a sense of their own British identity, slightly more troubled by a sense of an English identity. But immigration has been such a dominant theme in over the last sort of 15 to 20 years, not least since 2004, when the Eastern states joined the European Union and the Blair government chose not to introduce 7-year accession controls on freedom of movement, which they could have done under EU rules. The big economies, Germany, Spain, Italy, France, chose to impose those 7-year transition controls to on the accession states. UK, Sweden and Ireland didn't, which inevitably led to a huge influx of Eastern European workers into the country, which I welcomed personally. But it unsettled a lot of people and created what it led to was the greatest unplanned migration into these islands in British history, and that had consequences. And one of those consequences was it enabled the kind of the new populist right, nationalist right, to exploit it. I remember Nigel Farage, who I spoke to for the book, said to me he used 2004 and the arrival of the Eastern European migrants into the UK in large numbers to reopen the immigration debate, as he put it, which he believed had been closed down since the Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. So I think one of the challenges for the ruling elites, who obviously favoured more migrant workers arriving in the country, was to be truthful to the people, to tell them actually exactly what was happening, why it was happening, what the potential benefits were, as well as the challenges on schools and maternity units and on the welfare state. And I think one of the themes of the book is this absence of trust. I mentioned austerity and this idea that we are all in it together. I remember a speech Gordon Brown gave when he first became Prime Minister that he will create jobs for British jobs for British workers. Do you remember that? David Cameron pledging that he would reduce net migration to below 100,000. He never said how he would do that. And he knew under freedom of movement rules as members of the EU, he wouldn't have been able to do that. But nevertheless, they made these hollow pledges and hollow promises, British jobs for British workers and so on. We saw something similar when Tony Blair took us into the Iraq War. So all along, I think the elites, the political elites, haven't been honest. They haven't told the truth. They haven't leveled with the public. And that's what's created the sense of distrust.
There is this great moment in the book where you talk about Gillian Duffy in Rochdale from the 2010 election. And that is exactly that, with the collision of the elite meeting the public. And Gordon Brown dismissed her when she expressed her concerns about uncontrolled immigration as a bigot. But she was also talking, as you point out, about many other things, student debt and the underinvestment in her town and in other northern towns. What did that iconic moment tell you about the connection between the elite and electorate? And did it foreshadow the debate around Brexit a few years later, do you think?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right to call it an iconic moment. I think it's one of the big political moments of the last sort of 15 to 20 years. This is during the 2010 general election campaign, when Gordon Brown as Prime Minister, we're in the financial crisis now. Brown is trying to hold on to power, but clearly the new Labour years are coming to an end. Brown's campaigning in Rochdale, and he meets this lady, Gillian Duffy, a longtime Labour voter, he believes, who's disaffected. He didn't know she was disaffected when he was introduced to her in front of the cameras. One of his aides, a woman called Sue Nye, approached Gillian Duffy on the street and said, "Are you Labour?" She said, "Of course I'm Labour." And she said, "Would you like to meet the Prime Minister?" And she said, "Of course I'd like to meet the Prime Minister." And she was taken over to meet Gordon Brown. And it's a wonderful encounter. And it's on YouTube if you want to have a look at it. And she starts to ask him questions. And actually, she's quite politically literate. And her questions are probing. And you can see Brown's trying to flatter her and take control of the conversation, but she won't let him. She's like a very, very good political interviewer. She does raise the issue of migration, but not immediately. I think it's her fourth or fifth question. And she particularly asks about Eastern European migration. She doesn't make a racial point, I'm pleased to say. She also raises student debt, neglect in her hometown, national debt, and so on. And Brown's mic'd up. after the conversation ends, and he gets into his car. What he doesn't realize, there's a microphone on, and Sky News pick him up, dismissing her as a bigot. Later on, he discovers what's happened. He is aghast. He returns to her house later that afternoon, has a meeting with her, apologizes, and he thinks it's over. And as there's a wonderful moment as his car pulls away that afternoon when the cameras are on him. Initially, he's smiling, but there's a moment where the camera catches him and his face is frozen in absolute misery. And why it's so significant, I think, is that Mrs. Duffy represents a voter that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown associated with the past. You know, she was a conservative, small c conservative. They would perhaps have even called her a reactionary. She didn't embrace the new globalization that they embraced. She was unsettled by it. And although she seemed to be a figure from the past, in the book, the chapter about her, I call her a visitor from the future. Because that afternoon, what she did, she came to warn Gordon Brown and New Labour what was coming, what awaited the Labour Party over the next 10 years. And in many ways, Gillian Duffy had a better understanding of the political atmosphere or the social atmosphere of the country than Gordon Brown. And for a period afterwards, she became a kind of totemic figure. Both Miliband brothers sought her nomination during the Labour leadership contest after Brown had lost the election and resigned. David Miliband went to see her in Rochdale. She was brought to London to meet Ed Miliband after he became Labour leader. The local Labour MP, Simon Danchuk, became a close friend of hers. She opened his office. And for a period, she was sort of the voter that Labour had to win back. And then in the end, she was ultimately ignored by Jeremy Corbyn. And Keir Starmer never mentions her now. But she voted for Brexit. When I caught up with her for the book, she was a Brexit voter. I mean, she had abandoned the Labour Party in despair, and she opted for Brexit, as a third of the Labour vote did in those northern towns and those former Labour heartlands. So fast forward 9 years to general election of 2019, when Boris Johnson's Brexit Conservatives are running on a crude platform to get Brexit done, whatever that means. Boris Johnson was able to go into those old Labour heartlands and win. So many of those Labour voters, including in many former mining towns, switched. They switched from Labour, they backed Brexit, and they then voted for Boris Johnson in 2019. And we are where we are today. So I think that was an absolutely iconic political moment. And quite funny as well. It's quite comic. I mean, I've tried to write it also with a little bit of comedy because...
it was a very comedy day, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And also it was a wonderful moment because Sue Nye, who approached Gillian Duffy and said, "Are you Labour?" Sue Nye was known as Gordon Brown's gatekeeper. Well, she opened the gate that day and Gillian Duffy walked straight through it.
I want to go back to something you talked about earlier, which is Britishness versus Englishness. And the unease with which some people have about calling themselves English. There's a friend of yours, a Sicilian friend, who years ago you tried to persuade him to call himself English and he couldn't. And I completely understand that. But isn't the point about Britishness that it's a bit like the American dream? It's all embracing. We can all be British and it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or the colour of your skin. Can Englishness ever be like that?
That is the question. That is the defining question of really both for our conversation and indeed the book. You know, that's why I've called it Who Are We Now? Because I cherish Britishness. I think I value it greatly for the reasons that you articulate so well. But my worry is what happens if it's taken away? What happens if the British state breaks up? What happens if there's Scottish independence? That's why I'm so interested in the English question. What will that mean for England and Englishness? And can we create an English identity that is as accommodating as modern British identity is? That's the question, I think. I don't have definitive or decisive answers, but I'm asking those questions because I want to kind of explore the possibilities. And I hope encourage others to think about them as well. You know, what would that mean to lose that sense of Britishness, particularly so valuable since the Second World War, when we've had so many migrants arrive in the country. I think on the whole, harmoniously, and compared to any other European country, we haven't had a significant neo-fascist party or neo-fascist movement. You know, look at the French elections. You know, we've got the National Front, or what was formerly the National Front, the far right, for the second consecutive presidential election in the runoff against Macron. Eric Zemmour polled 7% in the French election, another far right populist, whereas you had the traditional center left, the socialists, and the traditional center right, the Republicans, collapsed. They polled below Zemmour. So that's the question I'm asking. And my friends, I grew up in this little cul-de-sac in Harlow in Essex once we moved away from Potter Street. And my neighbours were three Sicilian families. And their children, born in England, were my friends. You know, they spoke with a local estuary accent. They were very comfortable about calling themselves British. But I remember my friend said to me, look, I'm Sicilian, I'm Italian, and I'm British. Not England, never England. And he used to support the national Italian football team, of course. I understand why he supported the Italian national football team. And we were both Arsenal fans. But I wanted him also to call himself English. For some reason, that mattered to me. Although, of course, now all these decades later, I understand why he didn't and why he felt uncomfortable about it. I encountered similar attitudes when I started working in London and particularly at university with my black friends who were born in England. But nevertheless, they had a very strong sense of what they called a black British identity. And a black English identity then, in particular, I'm talking about the 80s, was more complicated, more contested. Although in recent times, I think particularly because of the success of what Gareth Southgate has achieved as England national football manager and the culture he's created around his young, diverse and dynamic multiracial team, I think we've begun to see a modern English identity, which is not too dissimilar from modern British identity, I'm pleased to say.
I think it is very interesting, and you talk about Southgate-ism, which is kind of like a new philosophy, really, that is combining, well, it is progressive patriotism. And you argue that Southgate really understands the difference between patriotism and nationalism, that you can take the knee and love your country, as you say. And, you know, we saw it Euro 2020 when, you know, the players draped the English flag around themselves. And he wrote that very poignant letter after the Black Lives Matter protests. But how do we get to that place? How do we get to that all-embracing Englishness where your Sicilian friends and your Black British friends can call themselves English?
Well, for a start, you make Gareth Southgate Prime Minister, perhaps, when he ceases to be England national football manager. But you know, Southgate's, he's in many ways, you know, he's a remarkable figure. And has a respect of his players. You know, some of them are political activists themselves, like Raheem Sterling around race issues, or Marcus Rashford around poverty issues, and others as well, such as Jordan Henderson and Tyrone Mings. And, you know, this guy has their respect, and he's someone who seems able to combine tradition and diversity in interesting and progressive ways, whereas so many of our politicians seem fearful of these issues. They either exploit them for their own populist ends, you don't need me to mention any names, or they avoid them. You know, the English question, for some reason, is very problematic for the left, I think, for some of the reasons we've touched on in this conversation. But that's, you know, that's what I'm after in the book. That's why the book ends, I think, hopefully, you know, I hope in the end, although some of the stories are painful that I explore, I hope I reach a point of accommodation and hopefulness. Because I do see change, some of it not always for the best. But I saw good things during the pandemic, you know, this terrible event that tested us all. But I did see moments of national unity, social solidarity, people being brought together across across divides. And that's why all the way along, I'm always looking for what I call this politics of the common good, you know, the things that unite us rather than divide us. And I do hope we can evolve a more open and tolerant and progressive English identity. It's certainly a more benign identity than it was when I was growing up at the end of the 70s and early 80s.
I mean, do you think, though, that the next generation who are not loaded with those memories of, you know, the National Front and hooliganism, who balk at the flag because they associate it with the dark days, do you think the next generation will have a different relationship to England and Englishness, that they embrace Southgateism in a way that this generation doesn't?
I think so and hope so. I certainly, you know, what we're calling Southgateism, which I love, actually, I love that word. I did see a flourishing of Southgateism around the Euros last summer, which obviously had been delayed by a year because of the pandemic, and all sorts of people were brought together around the flag. You know, one can't be complacent about it. These battles need to be won and fought. Fought and won, and then won again. These issues are always in play: national identity, the flag, the nation, patriotism versus nationalism. You know, these are big forces driving events right across, not just the UK, right across Europe and the rest of the world. And that's why you've always got to be vigilant, I think.
You quote Orwell in England, Your England, that the country has the power to change out of recognition and yet remain the same. Isn't the truth that England has just always been full of paradoxes?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And Orwell caught that beautifully, I think, in that sense of a changing changelessness. But the changes just over the last 25 years have been truly dramatic, haven't they? I mean, you began with Core Britannia and then took us all the way through to Brexit, the Brexit wars that followed, and then the pandemic. What a huge events that have been happening. There's also another line by Orwell, if I can find it. I might not be able to find it. If I can find it, he says, and I've got it: "It is of the deepest importance to try and determine what England is before guessing what part England can play in the huge events that are happening." He wrote that in 1940, as the bombs were falling on London during the Blitz, September 1940. Huge events were happening, and he wanted to determine what England is and what part England can play. That statement really is the starting point for my book. Today, I think huge events are happening again, and all I'm trying to do is work out, you know, what England is and what part England can play. But you're absolutely right. paradox is part of who we are, I think, and we have to accept ambiguity, we have to accept paradox, and also we have to accept that we're part of this complex, strange, but resilient multinational state, which isn't just one nation, but it's several.
Jason, thank you very much. Jason Cowley's book is Who Are We Now? Stories of Modern England, published by Picador, and is out now. You've been listening to Intelligence Squared with me, Kavita Puri. Thank you for joining us.